Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Broker-Dealer and Investment Advisor Examination and Enforcement Issues for 2018 conference call. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Fred Riesch. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you, Sophie, and hello, everybody. Good morning on the West Coast and good afternoon on the East Coast. I think we've got a great program for you today. I'm Fred Riesch. I'm in the Los Angeles office, and I'm an ERISA attorney who focuses on service providers to plans, including broker-dealers and RIAs. But that means I won't be saying much today because this is going to feature our SEC and FINRA attorneys, except at the end, Bruce Ashton, who is also here with me in Los Angeles and who is an ERISA attorney, is going to give you an update on the state law fiduciary standard activity. But the feature of our program is Sandy Granum, who's in our Florham Park and New York City offices. Sandy is the head of our FINRA practice group. Also with us today is Jim Lundy. Jim is a former SEC attorney and is a partner in our Chicago office. So we've got you covered nationally today. They're going to discuss the examination priorities, the 2018 exam priorities of both the SEC and FINRA, or at least the parts of it that they've picked to talk about today as the main part of our program. Having said that, though, it would be remiss if we did not acknowledge that at 3:30 Eastern today, the SEC is meeting to discuss new standards of care proposals for broker-dealers and registered investment advisors. At the end of the program, Jim and I will have a little back and forth about what to expect from the SEC meeting this afternoon. Then tomorrow afternoon, we have an Inside the Beltway call, which is a conference call that you all can register for, that will talk about what happened this afternoon. So we've got you covered on both ends. Today we'll talk about what to expect. Tomorrow we'll talk about what happened. Having said that, let me run through a couple other housekeeping things. This session is being recorded, and we will post it on our website. If you go to the website in a few days, you know, www.drinkerbiddle.com, and you look under Insights and Events, you'll be able to find it. Even better than that, though, if you registered anybody, as you must have, for this call, we will send you an email that says, hey, it's been posted, here it is. You can either listen again or share it with your comrades at your firm. By the way, I did want to mention that Bruce is replacing Brad Campbell today. Brad's fine, no problem. He just had a conflict and couldn't do the program. Having gotten those housekeeping things out of the way, let's jump into the deep end of the pool on the program today. And to do that, I want to turn it over to Jim and Sandy to talk about the examination priorities of the SEC and FINRA for 2018. Jim or Sandy, do you guys want to start it off?
So I'll lead off. It's Sandy Granum. I'm glad you could join us. FINRA produced their priorities a little bit earlier this year than the SEC, but as in prior years, there is coordination between the topics. And this year, I would say that the FINRA priorities are sort of divided between individual customer protection and market integrity. And many of the things that are being looked at by FINRA and which will be audited and inspected are things that are sort of popped out of the headlines of sort of what's cutting edge now in the securities industry. But FINRA, as has done in the past, has focused on vulnerable individuals, vulnerable customers, which are not necessarily older individuals, but can also be anyone 18 or older who has a physical or mental impairment. And they have been looking to make sure that those individuals are treated well and there is sufficient supervision in place to make sure that they are not being hoodwinked, I guess would be the word, by Ponzi schemes or micro-cap pump and dump schemes, where they are dealing with unsophisticated individuals, and there might be some not only abuse of the individuals, but manipulation of the market. And so I wanted to point out a couple of rules that have come to the floor recently. For instance, FINRA's Rule 2165 became effective February 5th, and in hand with that was amendments to Rule 4512. The 2155 rule gives the broker and the brokerage firm a safe harbor, so they can hold the distribution of assets or cash from an account if they suspect bad acts on the part of a third-party actor. So if they think that individual, a vulnerable individual, is being taken advantage of, they can refuse to transfer assets or cash out of the account. That rule does not apply to refusing to take a security order, so a buy or sell order is not covered by that rule, nor does the rule require that the broker-dealer hold the assets. It really is if the broker-dealer or the broker in their discretion determines that this is a bad actor, then they have a safe harbor for failing to follow the order to transfer the assets of security out. There are, of course, qualifications with that rule. They have to, within 2 days, notify somebody. They have to, within 15 rules, either release 15 days, either release the hold or extend the hold, depending upon what an internal investigation provides. But it does, however, permit the broker to have some safe harbor in doing so. In conjunction with that, you might ask, who would you call to advise that there's some bad act? Well, the amendment to Rule 4512, which was the rule that provided that you take information about the client along with the Know Your Client information, requires now that you ask for a trusted individual, and you don't have to get that information in order to open an account, but you must at least attempt to ask for that information when you're opening new accounts or when you're changing your account document. So you don't have to go back in history and get it, but to the extent that there's any new information being obtained from a customer that's not an institution, you would ask for those things. The other thing that comes to the floor quickly is a new customer due diligence rule that's going to be effective May 11th, which is sort of following up on both the Patriot Act and the Bank Securities Act, where you must now get beneficial information for accounts that are being opened beginning May 11th. That's, once again, not a historical look back, but going forward, you must acquire this beneficial information to sort of, in that case, it's really a market integrity rule to make sure that the market is not being abused. And there's a new rule that's coming to the floor on May 14th, which is Rule 2232, having to do with customer confirmations. And it provides information relating to whether there's a markup or a markdown on a particular trade and other special information, provided that the broker-dealer is selling corporate debt to a non-institutional customer. The market integrity side of FINRA's priority letter overlaps a lot with the SEC's priority letter in that they're looking, and Jim, jump in when you wish, but they're looking at cybersecurity, they're looking at anti-money laundering, they're looking at technology, and you know, they're looking at business continuity, and specifically cite to the Puerto Rican hurricane in terms of the kinds of planning that you have to have in place in case of crisis. So Jim, with regard to anti-money laundering, what is the SEC's priority letter say?
Thank you, Sandy, and good day, everyone. Pleasure to have you joining us. Not surprisingly, you know, AML is a priority again for both FINRA and the SEC. And where they focus, Sandy, consistent with what you mentioned about FINRA's efforts to require its member firms to obtain beneficial information, the AML customer identification programs applicable to broker-dealers vis-a-vis the Securities Exchange Act and Bank Secrecy Act are a priority. The risk from, I think, the SEC's perspective typically is heightened for any firms that have international affiliates or an international business. The other area that is a focus of the SEC based on the discussion in this year's letter is the timely and robust testing of the AML programs of broker-dealer firms, and including sufficient documentation of the testing, the results, and remedial efforts. And then I think the area that is going to be the greatest priority in the AML space for the SEC is suspicious activity report filing. And that has been building over time. It's an area that I think enforcement views as a priority as well as the examination program. The examination program obviously viewing it from a policy, procedure, process, and control perspective. But shortly after the release of this year's examination priorities from the Office of Compliance Inspections and Examinations, in late March, we saw the SEC's Enforcement Division file an action against a firm for failing to file suspicious activity reports regarding alleged customer manipulative trading. That firm was fined over $1 million. And while it has happened in the past, I think what was most significant about this particular action is consistent with enforcement for several years now, focusing on individual culpability. The chief executive officer and chief compliance officer of this broker-dealer firm were both charged individually. They settled. What's even a little more unique is a subordinate of the CCO was also charged. That individual is litigating, so there will be more to come on that front. But those, I think, are the main priorities for the SEC and OC looking forward. But by way of perspective, I wanted to share that recent SEC enforcement action, which I think amplifies, the risks in this space.
So the FINRA is also looking at monitoring, testing, and reporting. And SARS has always been a hot topic for FINRA. Interestingly enough, in the cybersecurity space, there's also a requirement for SARS reporting for the theft of customer IDs. So that extends.
Sandy and Jim, can I jump in for a second on the money laundering? It seems to me that there's a lot of it seems like I've read a number of articles and news reports about the money laundering issue being a very high priority, and the regulator is taking a very tough line on it, which would be consistent with what Jim is saying. Is that correct? And secondly, where should the people on the call focus their attention in terms of helping their firms avoid those kinds of problems? I'm throwing that out to both of you, so either one of you all can jump in.
I can start, Andy, if you'd like, unless you want to take it on, and
no,
then I can follow up.
Go ahead, I'll follow you.
Quickly, Fred, from the SEC perspective, most of the activity we have seen is unfortunately law by enforcement, and most of that activity has involved cases brought against firms regarding customer activity and firms not filing suspicious activity reports related to customer activity. You know, an example I'll give is the manipulation is where you see most of it, but it could be, an entity where a rep who threw some outside business activity that perhaps should have been recognized is running a Ponzi scheme. It's typically that type of very egregious conduct. And where the firms have exposure is when there's some sort of a breakdown between the suspicious activity reporting, monitoring, and filing process and the compliance efforts regarding the underlying conduct. It's a bit of the Monday morning quarterbacking that we've all seen now for several years, unfortunately, where failure to supervise actions are often brought as well when there's underlying egregious conduct of a rep and suspicious activity. Reporting failure cases are typically, from the SEC perspective, as I've seen them over the years, when there's a customer and or, pardon the term, kind of rogue rep issue, and the conduct was should have been recognized through some sort of internal surveillance or control process. It was, in fact, recognized, but when it was escalated, a suspicious activity report was not filed. Most of the time, the cases that are filed involve repeated violations or systemic failures, but it is a priority, and if the examination staff shows up, they're going to be proactively looking at firms' processes and their periodic testing and assessment of these types of systems. And then if enforcement ever shows up, much like the failure to supervise investigations and actions we've now seen, you know, for 10 to 15 years as follow-ons, a suspicious activity failure to report case is now another tool in their arsenal that they will bring when the facts and circumstances seem appropriate for them to do so.
So FINRA is in keeping with that. They're looking at suspicious activity relating to things like insider trading, microcap stock transactions where you're manipulating the market. They're looking for firms to have automated surveillance systems. You know, they heavily fine. There was a heavy fine against Credit Suisse back in 2016 of $16.5 million for sufficient deficiencies in its anti-monitoring laundry program. So it's looking for a robust written supervisory provision as well as automated systems and a mechanism for reporting. So oftentimes FINRA will see more of what's going on than an individual brokerage firm would. So in the case of insider trading, it has access to view more than one house. And if insider trading has taken place, oftentimes it will be a little bit of money at individual brokerage firms as opposed to one account at one brokerage firm. And so they can see it more readily than, for instance, a particular broker-dealer. On the other hand, if the broker-dealer has automated systems where it sees unusual movements of money or interestingly enough, wins that seem to be out of the ordinary in a typical circumstance, then they're expecting the broker-dealer to report that as suspicious activity.
Very good. Thank you.
I think one of the...
Go ahead, Jim.
I think one of the causes of confusion is... And I think it's a minority of firms that have this problem, but I think it's where you see some of the violative issues is because it derives from the Bank Secrecy Act and because people think of it as a banking and or perhaps international issue because the reporting requirement comes from Section 356 of the Patriot Act, that folks don't really perhaps have an understanding of the breadth and scope of what that language is. And when it comes to a broker-dealer, the SAR requirements to report are when there is any business or apparent unlawful purpose and the broker-dealer knows of no reasonable explanation for the transaction after examining the available facts. So that broad language encompasses, as Sandy mentioned, insider trading. You know, we gave manipulative trading as an example and other types of violative conduct that often comes the way of a well-functioning compliance process at a broker-dealer. And when that does happen, there needs to be some sort of appropriate inquiry and a resolution, and it all needs to be documented. If the resolution is such that there wasn't a potential violation that triggered the suspicious activity obligation under the Act, then there doesn't need to be a filing. But at a minimum, there needs to be that level of inquiry, documentation of the determination. And that track record needs to be there to support the robust system that the SEC and FINRA will be looking for with their examination programs.
I agree. Anti-money laundering has come a long way from just RICO cleaning bad money. It's very encompassing at this point. And I think that sort of brings us to the other topic I believe that, Jim, there's a lot of overlap on, which is cybersecurity. And FINRA requires that in the case where there is suspicion of identity theft that there be a SARS reporting. So even there, that's considered suspicious activity that's reportable to FINRA.
Yeah, I agree, Sandy. And to talk a little bit about where the SEC's priorities are in the cybersecurity realm, and I know we're going to talk a little bit in more detail about retail and retirement rulemaking towards the end of the call when we shift gears towards the SEC's open meeting this afternoon. But by way of context, I'll say that while that may be 1A on the SEC's priority list, 1B, and it's a close 1B, are the cybersecurity risks that the SEC sees for the industry. You know, the chairman has indicated this is one of his main focuses. The enforcement director last fall said that cyber risk is currently the greatest risk to the financial markets in the United States. And following through on that, you know, OC has had cyber risks on its examination priorities for some time now, but it has now been escalated to the top near where it assesses the retail and retirement risks, you know, the quote-unquote Main Street focus of the SEC. And what the priorities letter talks about is that OC is going to be coming in and examining and assessing the governance and risk processes around the cyber systems for firms, the controls regarding access rights, vendor management, which, you know, in the last 5 years or so has become a big issue that we have all seen, some of the largest cyber breaches that have gone public and resulted in tremendous reputational harm for various companies and firms have not been a result of insulated risks at that particular organization, but rather due to a risk created by a vendor or service provider who had access to the systems of the victimized entity. And a big priority is incident response, and the chairman has specifically spoke on that. By way of guidance, you know, I'll just share that I find the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which has a lot of guidance on cybersecurity risks and how to manage them, to be incredibly technical. But for some time now, going back several years, you know, the SEC put out cybersecurity guidance in 2014, and I think FINRA's 2015 report on cybersecurity is even better. They're written for a compliance and legal audience. I'm sure many of you have read those materials. If you haven't read them in some time, they're still good. They're still applicable. They're user-friendly. If you haven't had a chance to read them or you're new to a senior legal or compliance function, it's really required reading in this space, and it really gives you some practical guidance. You know, there's like checklists in there for processes you can develop to manage things like your vendor cybersecurity risk management and how to periodically go back and assess and test that and document those efforts. And so one thing I'll say is, you know, the SEC, to their credit, I think, has been really open about this particular risk. The OC has put out several risk alerts. I believe the most recent one was August of 2017. I'm sure many of us have read these things. But as you periodically plan and assess and update your policies and procedures and controls, you know, on an annual or more often interim basis, those are always good things to go back and read in addition to the new pronouncements that come out, because I expect more to come. In terms of enforcement, again, no one likes to see regulation by enforcement, but we are going to see more activity in that space from the SEC because last fall they created a specialty unit to focus on cyber enforcement issues, everything from some of the things Sandy mentioned regarding data privacy up to and including you know, cryptocurrency and ICO issues. So when they create those units have an appetite to bring cases, and that appetite needs to be fed. One of the ways that appetite gets fed is through examination referrals by OC. So you can anticipate that OC will not only be prioritizing this in the year to come and in future years, but they will have their antenna up for where the more significant findings are at particular firms and look very closely at whether those findings are serious enough such that they should be referring those matters to the enforcement division for an enforcement investigation and potential action.
I agree. And Jim is right. The 2015 report on cyber practices by FINRA is excellent. The checklist is referred to as the small firm cybersecurity checklist, which you can download and is very user-friendly. One of the other things that's on FINRA's list, which I think is in keeping with the cybersecurity view is technology governance. And FINRA will be looking to see that firms maintain strong controls over changes to their information technology to prevent things like inaccuracy or incomplete things and unauthorized changes to their product or environment, which goes along, I think, with the cybersecurity focus. They also are looking at cryptocurrencies, which everybody probably knows now is the hot thing in the market, and they're looking specifically at initial coin offerings, so ICOs, to monitor whether the registered representatives are being effective in transactions that would be considered securities, whether there's appropriate disclosure as to risk. So both for the market and the individual investor, they're looking at the cryptocurrencies. And you said, Jim, that the SEC has put into place a unit specifically looking at cryptocurrencies?
At cyber matters in general, Sandy, but they articulate four or five priority areas. You know, as you said, obviously with cryptocurrencies and initial coin offerings being such a hot button issue, that is one of the four or five issues and at the very top of the list.
Well, along the things that FINRA has articulated under its market integrity section of its priority letters is manipulation of the market, and they reference that they have revised their cross-market marking and open and close surveillance patterns to reduce false positives. They've enhanced the cross-market layering surveillance patterns in July 2017 to detect collusion, and they've also indicated they're looking at best execution and regulation regarding short trades. Is there anything particularly to note from the SEC with regard to market integrity?
It's listed, Sandy, as is typically the case on the priorities letter. They did not devote a lot of time to it in this year's letter. You know, admittedly, while I'm a proud alum of the SEC, I think FINRA just has a tremendous amount of technological resources and staffing such that I think what I've noticed over the years is for that issue, I think there's been a more deference placed with FINRA. But obviously, as you and I both know well, there's a tremendous amount of collaboration. I mean, I'm getting clients that are receiving information regarding things like possible manipulative activity or possible insider trading, where the level of detail you see in an initial FINRA inquiry or from an initial SEC inquiry based on a FINRA referral is almost granular in nature, where they are really pinpointed and targeted with the information they want in the market integrity space. And I think you know, one of the main reasons for that is the technological tools and manpower that FINRA devotes to this very important area. So I don't know if we want to switch to talk a little bit about the SEC Share Class Election Disclosure Initiative. Obviously, this is a registered investment advisor issue, so shifting our topics a little bit more from being broker-dealer focused. Well, that said, I think all of what we discussed is applicable mostly to all of the registrants. I just thought it would be a good idea, Fred, to maybe talk about that a little bit before we turn things over to Bruce and then move on to talk about the SEC's open meeting and anticipated proposed rule.
I agree.
So happy to do so. This initiative came out in February, and it's open until June. As the regulators tend to do, and as I'm sure almost all of you are aware, it has a bit of a friendly tone to it that, you know, if you do the work and you conduct an inquiry and you come in and self-report, we're going to give you credit for your proactive self-reporting and for cooperation. I think, like many things, the devil is in the details, so I'll just talk about those a little bit. Before I do that, in their release, the SEC defined what they call a self-reporting advisor. And that's an advisor who received 12B1 fees in connection with recommending purchasing or holding 12b1 fee paying share classes for its advisory clients when a lower cost share class of the same fund was available to those clients. And here's the tricky part, and failed to disclose explicitly in its form ADV the conflicts of interest associated with the receipt of such fees. They go on to say, to have been sufficient for that latter point, the disclosures must have clearly described the conflicts of interest. I think as a threshold matter for RIAs who sell 12b1 fees to their customers, you need to take notice of this. It should be deliberated with your colleagues and senior management if you haven't had a chance to do so yet. And you may be able to do a very quick risk assessment. I think it should be documented to show that you have paid attention to this important initiative so that when examiners show up and start asking questions, you can say that you did in fact conduct some due diligence. Now, for the firms who, after that initial triage effort, determine that there is a risk based on their practices, then you need to look at the details. And some things become very apparent when you peel back the layers of this onion. The first is, while it is a big incentive that the SEC has thrown out there, nevertheless, all of the other standard remedies remain on the table. Disgorgement, a cease and desist or censure-type order, a remedial plan that includes paying back the customers and client base who were in funds with 12b1 fees that relate to issues that were not adequately disclosed. Also, the charges are important. Many of us are familiar with the distinguishment between scienter and non-scienter-based charges. But the charges talked about in this release are nevertheless charges that, talk to things like operating as a fraud, failing to disclose or making untrue or material misstatements of fact in a registration application. So they are fairly egregious violations, and they present reputational risks that need to be weighed. So all very important high-stakes issues for the minority of firms who may have exposure to the enforcement division for this type of conduct. And I think to best manage that, if after some initial triage work, firms make the determination that they need to dig deeper, they need to coordinate, obviously, at a very high level with compliance and in-house counsel or perhaps outside counsel, develop an appropriate written project plan, and I think they need to understand the risk going into it, that while there is an incentive to avoid a civil penalty, all of the other things that go along with an SEC enforcement action are in play. A release, likely touting that this is a positive result of this initiative, the other charges that I mentioned, the remedies that I mentioned, et cetera, including the reputational risk. That all said, what weighs against the cautious approach is if firms really do unfortunately find themselves in a position where their business practices have put them in this risk, there is an incentive to report, because if they do not, I think those particular firms can expect to be hit very, very hard with significant penalties, individuals being charged, et cetera, et cetera. So some very important issues to think about. Like I said, for most firms, at a minimum, I think they need to take a close look at this, discuss it with senior management. Hopefully there's no issues there whatsoever, but the initial effort should be documented. For the smaller percentage of firms who have these risks, a lot more serious considerations that need to be considered and weighed in great detail.
Hey, Jim, this is Fred. Listening to you talk about it, it seems to me that the issue could go beyond 12b1 fees in the sense that it could be payments from custodians resulting from investment recommendations and the payments were disclosed, revenue sharing, marketing, anything that would be increased based on a recommendation that wasn't disclosed in the ADV or the advisory agreement. Certainly that's how it would work over on the ERISA side of the house for a fiduciary advisor. But is that true? Those would all be similar violations for the SEC?
If the disclosures are lacking, Fred, that's all true. And I actually agree with you. The initiative, the release related to the initiative spends a great deal of time talking about 12b1 fees and share class costs and disclosures related to those particular issues. But I think the expectation would be that firms who are going to do this self-assessment not do so with blinders on and only look at those two issues, but rather consider more broadly all of the examples that you just mentioned, Fred, which can result in conflicts in the investment advisor-client relationship if there is an issue with the related disclosures.
Now, also, Jim, again, drawing on my Department of Labor experience, even if an RIA who finds those violations doesn't go in under a self-correction program, but instead simply corrects by returning the money to the investor accounts, adding interest to it, and then stopping, you know, having any future payments paid over into the investor's accounts. If the DOL came in a year or two from now and it had been fully corrected in that way, I think the DOL would respect, in terms of any enforcement activity or the degree of enforcement, would respect the fact that it had been corrected and that the advisor was somebody who looked like they were trying to do the right thing but had made a mistake. Would the SEC view it in the same way?
That's a great question, Fred. The answer is I don't know. I'll tell you how they would have treated that conduct 2 years ago before the new leadership at the commission. They would not have cared, and they would have charged you. I think they have this program in place as an incentive, so they would like to see registrants come in and self-report. That said, as I mentioned, there's been a regime change, and I expect following through on the hypothetical that you mentioned and doing all of those things. So everything that a good corporate citizen investment advisory firm would be expected to do by a regulator, but for self-reporting. And 2 years from now, examiners show up and they find these issues and the registrant presents everything that they did proactively to remediate. I think that there is an incredibly strong argument that everything was done correctly such that there should not be a referral to enforcement or an enforcement action brought. So I think for firms that are hesitant for the self-reporting piece, I don't want to recommend that they not self-report in the middle of an open initiative, but I think that is the best practice to self-report based on this guidance if firms find themselves in that position after doing the assessment. But for firms that have such a significant hesitancy yet nevertheless want to do everything else in a proactive way regarding the remedial efforts, following the examples that you gave and the conduct you laid out, I think they would have very strong arguments to position themselves that 1 or 2 year down the line to avoid a referral or an action. They may not be successful, but I think they would be well positioned.
Okay. Well, Jim, should I go over to Bruce now on the state law issues?
I think so.
Okay. Hey, Bruce, it's your moment in the sunshine. And if you could give us like 5 to 7 minutes on where we are with the development of fiduciary and similar standards under state law.
Thanks, Fred, and good morning to you on the West Coast. Good afternoon to you on the East Coast. And this is a little change of pace. Just in case FINRA and the SEC aren't enough, the states are beginning to pile on as well, as you probably have been following. And we did attach a chart to the invitation to the webcast that summarizes at a fairly high level what states are up to. So I'll limit my comments to just a few of the key states. That said, let me start with Illinois. As the chart says, right now there is a bill pending that has a title, the Investment Advisor Disclosure Act, with no text. And from an attorney's perspective, that's a great bill because that leaves a lot of room for interpretation. But moving on to a little more substance, let me talk about Massachusetts, New York, and Nevada, and I'm going to throw in a little bit on New Jersey, too, if there's time permitting. Basically, Massachusetts is the tamest of the state proposals in that it is right now just a proposal to require registered investment advisors in Massachusetts to develop and provide a fee table. The table disclosure is pretty extensive, and basically what Massachusetts is saying is that the table is intended to increase transparency and help clients understand advisory fees because of changes in the financial services industry, such as use of third-party managers, robo-advisors to manage client assets, and so on. So right now, again, it's just a proposal, and it is, quote-unquote, just disclosure, though it's a when you look at the materials that the Massachusetts put out, it's pretty extensive. New York, moving on, is proposing to adopt something essentially a best interest standard for insurance sales. It doesn't relate to security sales per se, and it, at some level it can be viewed as and is described as an expansion of the suitability requirement. Though when you really look at it, it is similar to the DOL best interest standard under the probably soon to be gone best interest contract exemption that you're probably somewhat familiar with, in that it the proposal provides that a recommendation is in the best interest of a consumer if it is in furtherance of the consumer's needs and objectives and is made without regard to the financial or other interests of the producer, insurer, or other party. So it isn't a fiduciary standard in the strict sense, and it also, by the way, doesn't apply to sales to plans and and employer-sponsored IRAs. Those are exempt from the application of the rule, but it does apply to sales to individuals, regular IRAs, and other investors that are not exempted. Moving on to Nevada, it's probably the most robust in the sense that it is the most expansive, and it says that financial planners, as defined in the Nevada law, have the duty of a fiduciary to the client. So it would essentially impose a fiduciary duty on broker-dealers, RIAs, and their advisors for sales of securities. In the case of Nevada, insurance sales are exempt from the rule. So New York, you know, focuses on insurance sales. Nevada focuses on security sales, but not insurance sales. And the interesting thing about the Nevada rules is that there's no real definition of what the fiduciary duty means, and it's all dependent on regulations, which are not haven't been released yet or even proposed. It's also unclear from the statute, which is really quite short, what transactions it would apply to. In other words, it's presumably applies to advice given in Nevada or given to Nevada residents, but again, it's not entirely clear what it applies to. And as I say, it's dependent on the release of regulations, which haven't been proposed yet. New Jersey is not to be left out, is coming along and is proposing to require disclosure of fiduciary status, which at one level doesn't sound so bad, except it goes on to say, if you're not a fiduciary, you have to disclose that too. And the way they've worded the disclosure of not being a fiduciary, to me, I would be uncomfortable making those statements to a client because it says, I'm not acting in your best interest and I'm acting basically only in my interest. It's not quite that bad, but it's pretty close. Uncomfortable. Yeah, pretty close. And it's also not clear to me, at least, how fiduciary status is defined. What standard applies to whether you're a fiduciary or not. In addition, New Jersey has just come out with a proposal for fee disclosures for 403B plans, similar to what I believe it's Connecticut is also requiring. So stay tuned on that. And frankly, stay tuned on all of this, because depending on what the SEC does, perhaps this afternoon, and what the DOL does in the future in terms of fiduciary standards, we could see a lot more from the states, because they may decide that what the SEC and DOL are doing is not sufficient. So with that, let me turn it back to Fred to talk about the SEC's activities this afternoon.
Bruce, that was great. Thanks for doing that so quickly. At 3:30 this afternoon, East Coast time, there's an open meeting of the SEC, as Jim mentioned. There are three items on the agenda. Let me rattle them off and then turn it over to Jim to talk about what our expectations are. The first is that the SEC will be looking at rules and forms to require registered investment advisors and broker-dealers to provide a brief relationship summary to retail investors. That's number one, a summary of the relationship. Number two, they'll be looking at a standard of conduct for broker-dealers when making a recommendation of any securities transaction or investment strategy involving securities to a retail customer. Number three, looking at interpreting and guidance a standard of conduct for investment advisors. So, Jim, with that foundational statement by me, tell me what you see happening this afternoon.
Sure, happy to do so. I'm hoping I don't get anything wrong. I wish I could give the admonishment I used to give when I was at the SEC and used to speak that these are my views and not the views of the SEC. So these are my views and not necessarily the views of Drinker Biddle, but I'm happy to share them. First of all, I think Bruce, as he wrapped up his points, raised a really good point, which is that there may be a perceived vacuum that this state activity is trying to fill. That vacuum grew immensely with the Fifth Circuit ruling, and it's likely not a surprise to anyone that the timing of this rule is occurring now with the open meeting scheduled later today and the anticipated release of a proposed rule, as opposed to sometime further down the line in 2018. Things seem to have moved very quickly based on the monitoring we were all doing, Fred, and including discussions you and I and Sandy were having with our sources at SIFMA CNL, you know, just a month ago, when folks were saying that the chairman had a very lengthy, very detailed rule on his desk, and he was hesitant to circulate it and try to do the work that needs to be done to get unanimity for a proposed rule to be issued, because Commissioners Pierce and Jackson were still relatively new. I think the Fifth Circuit ruling changed all that. I think that while they're new, there's been a tremendous amount of effort to get everyone on, they say, quote unquote, the 10th floor in that building up to speed, such that they could do this accelerated effort to have the meeting this afternoon and to issue a proposed rule thereafter. You know, that said, while that effort has been accelerated, our sources and intelligence are telling us that they obviously anticipate a voluminous amount of comment letters, and that a final rule likely will not be issued until sometime towards the end of 2018. You know, firms, both RIA and broker-dealer firms, are going to be impacted by this rule, and participating actively in the comment letter process is going to be very, very important. So I'll just back up and talk about these three points. We've all seen discussion about title reform. You know, who is your advisor or rep? What do those titles mean? It's not in this point, but, you know, Jim Lundy's perspective, I think it is. I think it's embedded in this point. I think this form, this brief relationship summary that is going to be proposed is going to encompass that. I don't think it's going to be anywhere near as involved as a form like Form ADV, which essentially turns into an RIA annual report. But I think it's going to be a form that will drive the customer onboarding relationship in the retail space for both RIAs and BDs. And while there's a lot of processes built around that from a compliance and supervisory perspective, at the end of the day, a lot of that form is just evolved from a contractual arrangement. But I think this form that is going to be proposed is going to take that and move it forward to a specific regulatory requirement with parameters and structure around it to encompass several things, including the issues regarding title and certification. The broker-dealer standard of conduct, I think that's the one we're all waiting for. Notably, the word fiduciary is not used here. We don't see the word best interest here. But they're going to be making a significant effort, I believe, to try to get more clarity around this standard of conduct, and that likely will be a rule that will result in changing the Securities Exchange Act, Section 15, that governs broker-dealer conduct from the SEC perspective. And Sandy, please jump in at any point regarding your anticipated views on FINRA and their suitability rule. And then lastly, before I turn it over to Sandy and Fred and anyone else to jump in, this interpretation of the standard of conduct for investment advisors. I think we all know that historically and for decades, investment advisors have operated with a fiduciary relationship with their clients as opposed to a suitability standard. However, from a regulatory perspective, not a case law perspective, there's just not a lot in the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 in the statutes or in the rules that talk about that standard in any level of specificity. And I think that's what the goal is here, is to come up with a standard with some more specificity. And then I think a goal related to that is for these last two points, for that more specific investment advisor standard for retail and retirement client business to align with this new standard of conduct for the broker-dealers who are going to be working with customers who have, retail and retirement business. So I think two and three, I think ultimately the goal is to have those be related, but nevertheless to preserve the infrastructure that the SEC has had for decades, that the broker-dealers and investment advisor industries are regulated differently, while perhaps the businesses are treated the same in the private sector. So I think we're still going to see the SEC regulate the broker-dealer space pursuant to Section 15 and the rules they're under of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, and I think that's where we're going to see that proposed rule for point two. And I think we're also going to see the Investment Advisors Act with rules related to this interpretation of the standard of conduct for investment advisors, and that I think that's going to dovetail with the efforts being made with this broker-dealer standard.
So, Jim, I agree with you, and I think that we can both say that we do not speak for the SEC, right? So we will wait with bated breath to see what comes out at 3:30. But I believe that items 2 and 3 are meant to do exactly what the SEC determined the problem was. The problem was initially the public was confused by what it meant to be a broker versus what it meant to be an investment advisor and who owed them which a duty, right? What was the duty that was associated with one and the other? And I think the conversation about what titles should be given to brokers, can they use the word financial advisor? Or is that just helping to confuse the public about who has what duties, is why they're asking for that initial sort of description about what you do and presenting that to the client. So while the DOL had you identify yourself as a fiduciary in order to get certain exemptions, and then you were contractually bound by that contract, I think here what the SEC is doing or will likely want to do is really distinguish between the duties and responsibilities of a broker versus an investment advisor. So the public is clear who is doing what and who owes them which duty. And that then, having been presented in a writing, is something that the SEC can enforce. So I believe all three of them are tied together with probably the unified goal of clarifying for the public who's got what role. And I agree that their fiduciary duty is not mentioned in Chairman Clayton's discussions. In no one's discussion was there ever the word fiduciary duty. There was always the standard of care. And in the priority letters as well, there's no discussion of fiduciary duty. There is, however, discussion of suitability. And so I do not anticipate that there will be a a conduct requirement that includes the word fiduciary in it, but it very well may be just a clarification on what suitability is and how that is distinguished in the case of a broker from an investment advisor.
Yeah, you know, I would also think, just from listening to the speeches of the commissioners, that even if the words duty of loyalty aren't used, that there is going to be some increase in the standards in that area of putting the investor's interests ahead of the advisor's in both categories, broker-dealers and RIAs. Even though they didn't say that on the agenda, I just get a gut-level feeling that that is part and parcel of what's going on. Well, having said that, operator Sophie, we've got a couple minutes left for some questions. Will you see if there are any questions?
Absolutely. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. And a voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. And once again, please press star 1 to ask your question. And we'll pause for just a moment.
Well, Jim, while we're pausing, what do you think about what I said about the duty of loyalty?
I agree. I think that's a. I think it's a goal, Fred. I think there's the goal with clarity is to, as Sandy said, have the public be better advised on who they're sitting across from and what the particular rules are going to be that are applicable to the relationship. I think the rules will continue to have some differences due to the genesis of the industries and the regulations, but I do think as part of the clarity, they're going to try to make them more aligned for retail and retirement customer activity.
Operator, do we have anyone?
We do have a question. We'll go to our first participant.
Hello there.
Hello. Hi.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Dan Jamison with Financial Advisor. Hi, Fred.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Hey, question. I just wanted to make sure I got, you mentioned the circuit court decision, and I may have missed that. Could you repeat that, if you will, the circuit court decision that was sort of spurring the SEC to act now?
Yeah, I think Jim was referring to the decision on March 15th of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Chamber of Commerce case. And Jim, I think you said that probably sped up the process a little bit. Is that right?
Fred, yes.
Yeah. That was where the three-judge panel, by a 2-to-1 vote, vacated the fiduciary rule, meaning the fiduciary regulation and all the exemptions. And if something is vacated, it's as if it never existed. Which means that it would be retroactive, that we never would have had the fiduciary rule as we refer to that package, not yesterday, not a month ago, not on June 9th of last year. The betting is that the Department of Labor will not challenge that decision, but that hasn't been announced. I think there's still a 20-30% chance, and I'm making up these numbers, to be honest. But my feeling is there's a 20-30% chance that the DOL will challenge it, but that means there's a 70-80% chance that they won't. We'll know by the end of April. They've got to get it done by April 30th. So that's what we were talking about. That made that lit a fire, possibly, under the SEC to get their rule out, and that's why we think they've moved so quickly.
Right. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, sure.
And it appears there are no further phone questions at this time.
Well, let me ask one more question of Jim and Sandy, and then we'll be done with it. Jim and Sandy, we talked about the fiduciary rule, but at some level, that's just a label. You have to look at what the actual rule is for it to make any sense. And as I look at recent guidance by the SEC and by FINRA, it seems to me that they have moved more to what I think of as a fiduciary rule of their own volition. And let me give you two examples. One example is FINRA Regulatory Notice 1345, which essentially says that a recommendation to take a distribution from a plan and roll over to an IRA has two securities recommendations involved in it. One is a recommendation to liquidate the securities inside the account in the 401k plan, and the other is how to reinvest them in the account and in the IRA. Both of those then are subject to Rule 2111. And they list in there the different things you have to, that an advisor should look at in order to make a suitable recommendation, and its investments, services, and expenses are among them, which is exactly what the DOL says under the fiduciary rule. Then the SEC and its retire initiative said, the account that you recommend that the money be in is a recommendation you have to have a reasonable basis for, and they footnote it to FINRA Regulatory Notice 1345. I mean, I look at that and say, man, there's not much of a difference between the three regulators, FINRA, the SEC, and the DOL. Am I just looking at an isolated incident, or is there some ratcheting up of the SEC, of the standards that the SEC and FINRA are holding advisors to?
I think there is a convergence in all three, Fred, and I think the SEC was on the sidelines for a while. You know, folks probably have forgotten because there's been so much going on in this space, but you know, the SEC attempted to pass a rule, and they did finalize a rule in 2005, Rule 202A11-1 of the Advisors Act, but it was struck down by the D.C. Circuit, much like the Fifth Circuit striking down the DOL's efforts, and there was a time where they were gun-shy. I think what we saw a couple of years ago is they're not as gun-shy as they used to be. I think while some investor advocacy groups may hope for more out of this afternoon's meeting and more out of the proposed rule, the reality is consistent with what you said, Fred, that I think there's been a significant convergence and prioritization of these retail investor issues amongst these various regulators.
And I also believe that for a very long time, as Jim says, the SEC has known that it needed to do something to clarify the perception in the public about what duties prevailed for their investment advisors and or brokers. But there was not an ability to align the commissioners, and so the SEC was frozen in place. But I agree with you, Fred, that the standard of what is appropriate and what's not appropriate is very much the same. The word that isn't being used, however, is the fiduciary duty rule. And I believe that along those lines, there won't be sort of this preference for a level fee.
Yeah, that makes sense, Sandy. Well, thanks, everybody. Bruce, Sandy, Jim, you guys were great. Y'all in the audience, I hope that this program worked well for you. A couple of reminders. One, the state law materials were attached to the invitation. Another reminder is that we've recorded this and we will post it. The third reminder is that we're doing a Beltway program, a conference call like this one called Inside the Beltway Tomorrow. And if you haven't already registered for it, why don't you go to our law firm website, one word, drinkerbiddle, as one word, .com, and then do a search for Inside the Beltway. That's the easiest way to get to an invitation and a registration for the program tomorrow. And tomorrow, today we postulated. Tomorrow we'll tell you what actually happened. So once again, thanks everybody. We really appreciate your time. We hope this worked out well for you. Operator, that's it.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.